Hello, everybody. This is Angela Glosser, your Good News On Demand volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today, I'm going to read an article from GQ called The Great Italian Tailoring Crisis, written by Joshua Hunt. It appeared in the magazine on September 26, 2023. Over the past century, the master tailors of Naples have become among the most renowned in the world. Today, without an urgent effort by younger generations to preserve the dying craft, Italy's legendary tradition could go extinct. This story was featured in The Must Read, a newsletter in which our editors recommend one can't-miss GQ story every weekday. On a balmy morning in June, I arrived early for my appointment with Mariano Rubinacci, whose atelier overlooks cobbled streets that stitch together the very small, very exclusive world of bespoke Neapolitan tailoring. Perched above a flagship store selling shirts and ties, his sartoria, or tailoring shop, is located in the 16th century Palazzo Cellamare. The Bay of Naples is close enough to perfume its entrance with each gust of wind blown inland from the Mediterranean Sea. Inside, the dewy summer air mingles with the smell of good coffee, fine fabric, and old money. Naples is Italy's third largest city, but in tailoring it is second to none. Those who doubt this can check the paperwork. In an ornate frame hanging on the wall of Rubinacci's salon is a weathered document from 1941 addressed to his father, Gennaro, from the Prince of Piedmont, appointing him as clothier to Italy's royal family. Gennaro Rubinacci opened the legendary Sartoria, London House, in 1932, as a kind of Italian outpost for Savile Row tailoring traditions. The heavy English suit was a status symbol in Naples, where British aristocracy spent summers mingling with high society families like the Rubinaccis. What made London House famous was not its eye for tailoring traditions, which stretch back nearly 700 years in Naples, but rather a willingness to discard some elements of the English suit that were ill-equipped to the warmer Mediterranean climate. Vincenzo Attolini, who was then the head cutter at Rubinacci, is credited with stripping out the horsehair, canvas, and shoulder padding usually associated with the English suit jacket. Attolini, who is considered the father of modern Neapolitan tailoring, added signature touches like barchetta, or little boat pockets, which some believe are named for an angle resembling the bow of a sailboat floating across the chest. He used fine fabrics and little else to create a light, soft, elegant silhouette that soon became the signature of Neapolitan tailoring. By the time Gennaro died in 1961, the unstructured, light-as-a-shirt Neapolitano jacket had become an institution, one carried on by Attolini and other bespoke tailors. The term bespoke refers to the name for the spoken-for bolts of fabric that had to be ordered ahead when making a custom suit. Decades later, their influence was apparent in the work of designers like Giorgio Armani, whose deconstructed, oversized suits defined the elegance of the 1980s through adherents including Richard Gere and Eric Clapton. Entering the global zeitgeist was only possible at scale, however, which is why big names like Armani made their fortunes in the ready-to-wear market. Even the most luxurious made-to-measure suits, which combine personalized measurements with stock patterns, fall short of the custom patterns and other bespoke traditions practiced at Rubinacci, where Mariano took over the family business after his father died. "I was 18," he told me. "I am very proud of my job and very enthusiastic to follow the work of my father." Mariano, who is now 80, has since changed the sartoria name from London House to Rubinacci, and has opened new stores run by his son, Luca, in Milan, and his daughter, Chiara, in London. When we met at his salon in Naples, he wore brown trousers that matched his spectacles, with suede loafers on his feet and a Rolex on his wrist. The sleeves of his dress shirt were rolled up to the elbow as he stood before a table piled high with fabric samples. Because I had arrived early, he was still busy helping a client, Calvin Klein, who, according to Mariano, first came to Rubinacci years ago on the recommendation of Jean Pressman, the grandson and heir to the founder of Barney's. Lean and gray-haired, the American fashion icon lounged on a sofa at the back of a room, drenched in the patina of three successive Rubinacci family fortunes, one in shipping, another in antiques, and finally one in men's clothing. Like most clients, among them actors, tycoons, and royalty, Klein values his privacy. Making suits, Mariano told me, is like being a doctor. And to preserve the intimacy of Klein's experience, he asked his daughter, Alessandra, to give me a tour of the workshop upstairs. Near the top of a stairway overlooking the salon, there was a spot from which I could see the interplay of supply and demand. To my left, on the floor below, Rubinacci serves as a kind of orchestra conductor, he told me, fitting clients for bespoke suits that start of over $5,000 each. To my right, in the second floor workshop, 20 or so master tailors work on making them to Rubinacci specifications. For centuries, these forces were kept in balance by tradition as much as market dynamics. A young man in need of a suit went to his father's tailor, and an old tailor in need of an apprentice turned first to his own son. It's a trade that takes years to learn. Strictly speaking, a master tailor must be able to make every part of the suit themselves, from start to finish. Recently, though, a breakdown in tradition has thrown the world of Italian tailoring off its axis. Many young people now don't want to do this kind of art, Alessandra told me, but it's a very, very important that it continues. Tailoring's uncertain future in Italy is what brought me to Naples. It reminded me of something I'd seen some years ago while living in Tokyo, a declining birth rate and broader access to higher education, among other trends, has left craftspeople of all kinds, furniture makers, potters, gold leaf artisans, without successors. In bespoke Italian tailoring, similar forces have constrained supply, despite demand that appears robust and poised to rise along with the number of global millionaires, which Credit Suisse predicts will grow some 40% by 2026. In 2022, the Italian National Institute of Statistics reported that Italy had fewer than 7 newborns and more than 12 deaths for every 1,000 inhabitants, and its old tailors are dying faster than they can be replaced. To see what this labor crisis looked like and how it was being met, I traveled to Naples for a glimpse behind the curtain at three of the finest sartorie in the world, Rubinacci, Ciardi, and Panico. At Rubinacci, the problem was evident in the abundance of elbow room in the second floor workshop. A decade ago, the company was producing about 1,500 suits annually. This year, they will make roughly half as many. To combat this trend, Rubinacci has prioritized hiring tailors in their 20s or 30s. But even so, he told me, you have to be lucky to find the right people. Each tailor speaks his own language, not in terms of words, but in terms of mentality. And for this reason, the same tailor who made Calvin Klein's first Rubinacci suit will be responsible for making his next one. If you use a different tailor, he said, the construction will be different. Each tailor, too, is the keeper of their own traditions, standards, and secrets. Today, it is very difficult, Tailoring is a very difficult job, Rubinacci said, with countless variables. After taking a client's measurements, bespoke tailors create an original pattern, then cut the cloth and prepare it for stitching. When you sell a suit, you know what you are doing, Rubinacci said, but you don't know the results. You may use 40 hours. You can use 60 hours easily, because if the suit doesn't work properly, you have to make it and remake it. The speed at which this crisis is becoming an existential threat seems to have taken everybody by surprise. After mentioning a long tradition of fathers and sons working side by side, Alessandra could find just one second generation master tailor whose father had worked at Rubinacci in the workshop. Pepe, age 45, told me his apprenticeship began at about 12, and little by little, through helping his father, he made a career for himself. It was only natural that he should follow in his father's footsteps, he said. When I asked if he had a son to follow in his own footsteps, he replied, "Not yet." Rubinacci, who met me in the lobby of the Sartoria a short while later, sleeves rolled down, wearing a brown Neapolitan jacket, cut in what once was known as the Vincenzo style, said he felt lucky to have a successor. It seemed to me that at 80, he might not see some of his clients again, especially since the ultra-wealthy in general, he told me, sometimes buy so many suits at once that they have no reason to return for a decade or more. His son Luca's success as creative director for the business, Chiara's success in London, and Alessandra's work at the Naples Sartoria have given him confidence. It's something that you have to be proud of, he said. And yet, like their father, they are conductors, taking measurements and guiding the work of the master tailors they count on to cut and stitch each suit. And like any conductor, they are subject to the limitations of their orchestra. Every tradition is its own paradox. For however long it endures, it seems durable. And yet, with each passing moment, the world it was created for slips further from existence. When the need for any particular tradition has gone entirely, and it exists solely in tribute to the way things were, it becomes especially vulnerable to the way things are. Any social, demographic, or economic change can push it further toward the margins until suddenly it vanishes like the sun beyond the horizon. Gaetano Aloisio was born in 1963 in the southern region of Calabria and started training as a tailor at age 11 after school, something he said is no longer possible these days. At 16, he moved to Milan to study for 4 years at Cesare Tosi's Sartoria, which at the time, he said, was being run by the master tailor Ennio Bolognesi. Next, he moved to Rome and attended tailoring school while working at the famous Sartoria Luzzi. In 1986, at the age of 22, Aloisio bested his peers from throughout Italy to become the youngest ever recipient of the prestigious Forbici d'Oro, or Golden Scissors. It is an award, he later said in Yoshimi Hagasawa's book, Italian Tailoring, that seals one's destiny. Like most famous Italian tailors, Aloisio eventually cultivated a largely overseas clientele. But in this case, it wasn't the dramatic ups and downs of Italy's economy, but rather an early 90s crackdown on government corruption that he said led to a plunge in his domestic business. Aloisio's first atelier was scarcely a year old at the outset of a nationwide judicial investigation known as Mani Puliti, or Clean Hands, involving alleged kickbacks among politicians, civil servants, and business executives. Dubbed Tangentopoli, or Bribesville, by the press, it created a crisis for Italy's makers of luxury goods. Aloisio's most important customers were politicians, who, though not directly involved, he said, felt the need to keep a lower profile. He estimated losing some 60% of his customers between 1993 and 1994. Aloisio cut costs by moving his shop to a cheaper location, then courted new business throughout Europe and the Middle East by going directly to his prospective customers rather than waiting for them to come to him. By 1998, he not only recovered, but also found a successful business model seeming less exposed to domestic whims. Since then, he told me, his sales have grown steadily, year by year. So steadily, in fact, that the labor crunch of recent years has forced him to change his production methods to keep up with demand for his bespoke suits. Instead of having each one made by a single tailor from start to finish, Aloisio has adopted an assembly line approach that requires far less training for new recruits. They don't learn to make every part of the suit, as master tailors must do, and so can start working much sooner. Since they might not become master tailors themselves, Aloisio does not necessarily have to worry about them leaving to start their own shop. What he does have to worry about is whether this short-term solution will have long-term consequences for an industry desperately in need of more master tailors. This is hardly an abstract problem for Aloisio, who serves as president of the National Academy of Tailors, overseeing a prestigious 3-year training program in Rome. The best way to learn this art is to start very early, very young, Aloisio said. But since that is no longer possible, he considers tailoring school the next best option. And yet, he concedes, that students cannot be complete tailors after 3 years. Taking charge of a tailoring school has given him a first-hand education in the many variables complicating the industry's labor crisis. For years, Aloisio told me, he has put special emphasis on attracting more young people, whose view of the trade may appear to some as decidedly unglamorous. He does this so that prospective students might realize it is a profession that can bring them enormous success. Behind this hardscrabble image are some sobering statistics. According to the Economic Research Institute, average salaries for customs tailors range from about 20,000 euros to 32,000 euros in Italy, which according to the ERI is quite a bit less than the average salary of a plumber there. To a surprising extent, Aloisio has noticed a pronounced increase in the number of young people enrolling in the academy school. One aspect of this turnaround might be the fact that so many of Italy's most famous sartori now have tens or even hundreds of thousands of followers on social media, like Instagram, where Mariana Rubinacci won't be seen posing with Calvin Klein, but son Luca, who is in his mid-40s, often posts photos of his Ferrari and his collection of luxury wristwatches. Even more than the sheer number of young people interested in tailoring, Aloisio has observed a shift in demographics. Increasingly, instead of working-class candidates, those coming into the profession, he said, are solidly middle-class, even wealthy. The problem with this, Aloisio soon realized, is that most of them don't appear to want apprenticeships after they graduate, nor do they wish to spend years working in the back rooms that will transform them into master tailors. Young people nowadays, Aloisio said, they don't want to wait. They don't want to understand that in this line of work, to become a great tailor, you need great knowledge. It seemed to me that because they started life in the middle or at the top, they have no desire to go anywhere but up and quickly by putting their basic knowledge to use in some other corner of the booming luxury apparel market. Young people now don't come to tailoring wanting to become workers in great tailor shops, he told me. They want to become entrepreneurs. He continued, Today, the young people we are training unfortunately don't guarantee us tailors and our tailor shops a workforce for the future. There are some students, however, that give him hope for the future. One of these is the improbably named Ivan Americano, who is 29 and grew up in Basilicata in the south. Prior to studying at the National Academy of Tailors, he briefly worked for the LVMH brand Emilio Pucci and has worked for Alessio since he was a student and is presently a second cutter, one of the most coveted and important positions, he told me. At the academy, he was able to circumvent what Rubinacci had called the very jealous nature of tailors, who he claimed sometimes hold back secrets and techniques from even their own sons. Americano grew quickly by taking the opportunity to work in shops run by his instructors whenever the opportunity presented itself, and now knows how to make every part of his suit, unlike some co-workers, and not only cuts fabric, but attends fittings and sometimes meets clients. Rather than going back to work for a major luxury brand, he told me, it would be an honor for me to one day inherit the reins of a growing empire. Others might be content to work for luxury brands like Balenciaga or Gucci, where graduates are seen as educated rather than untested. In bespoke tailoring, their skills would be tested, their credentials challenged, unlike elsewhere in the industry. Young people today are in a rush. They don't want to wait, says Alessio. But to become a tailor, you need to know the work and the profession at 360 degrees. They may look at a famous tailor with a shop of his own and fail to appreciate the fact that he first spent years or even decades working behind the scenes for someone else. Instead of apprenticing alongside elder tailors or working to perfect their craft in the back room of someone else's shop, more seem to want to go into business for themselves almost immediately. Consequently, rather than the profession dying out, Alessio's fear, he said, was that the next generation of tailors would sink into mediocrity. Collectively, my four subjects had spent about a total of approximately 200 years looking at clients who walked through the same doors I would, scrutinizing their gait, posture, and proportions for some sense of who they are and who they might yet become. Rather than submit to this kind of sartorial psychoanalysis, I gave up trying to dress well in front of men who would see through whatever costume I put on. I showed up in Rubinacci wearing the same clothes I wear on long flights, Carhartt work pants and a plain t-shirt, and found it so liberating that I dressed even worse for my appointment at Sartoria Ciardi. If London House represents the origins of modern Neapolitan tailoring, the traditions of its golden era are perhaps most faithfully enshrined at Ciardi. Its late founder, Renato Ciardi, was born in 1934 in Naples, where he started his training under master tailor Angelo Blasi. He later spent 3 years in Rome working at the woman's clothier, Schubert. Ciardi first established his own sartoria in 1954, when there were 9,000 tailors in Naples, he told Yoshimi Hagagaswa, and they were all excellent. Ciardi distinguished himself with workmanship emphasizing the natural contours of the body. Between gently curved shoulders and slim waists, the fabric of a Ciardi jacket cascades cleanly down the spine of the wearer. This extreme dedication to su misura, or on measure, tailoring might account for the favored status he enjoyed among Italian movie stars, as well as the dancer Rudolf Nureyev and the mafioso Lucky Luciano. It also earned him prestigious Italian tailoring awards such as the Gran Premio Vita di Sarto, or Life of a Tailor, in recognition of his lifelong contributions to the profession. He continued working till his death in 2017. These days, his sons, Vincenzo and Roberto, continue running the family business. When I visited Sartio Chiardi, I was pleased to find Vincenzo Chiardi dressed casually in blue jeans, sneakers, and an open-collar dress shirt with rolled-up sleeves. A day earlier at Rubinacci, dressing not to impress had landed me in the withering gaze of one sharply dressed tailor. My espresso went down much smoother at Chiardi, where Vincenzo led me into the salon, while Roberto met with a fabric dealer in the next room. If not for the abundance of fabric and the length of yellow measuring tape strung around his neck like a tie that hadn't been knotted, it would be easy to mistake Vincenzo for a painter or a sculptor. He has the strong hands and slightly wild demeanor of an artist. Vincenzo has been working with his hands since the age of 18, when he first began training with his father. Roberto, who soon joined us for coffee, is a bit leaner and taller than his older brother and started his training a bit earlier at age 17. Today they are in their late and mid-50s, and everything they know about their trade was learned the old-fashioned way, which is to say very, very slowly, over the course of more than 3 decades. Their father once said, by the age of 40, a first-rate tailor is already worn down by a lifetime of hard training and even harder work. His sons, both tailors of the highest pedigree, laughed when I mentioned this. Roberto replied, it was passion that kept them going. Unlike Rubinacci, who does fittings and passes measurements and instructions along to his tailors, the Chiardi brothers work shoulder to shoulder with a small team of employees. Two of them are over 70, and when they retire, replacing them may not be possible. It's not just about finding a worker capable of tailoring at a high level, which is its own challenge, but also about the instincts and experience that accumulate across 5 decades in the job. What older generations of tailors know can be learned, but can't necessarily be taught. In the coming years and decades, when the oldest of them are gone, bespoke tailoring as we know it may die with them. Without going so far as to speak ill of their competitors, I found each tailor willing to hold forth on the standards to which any truly bespoke suit must rise. Behind closed doors, they criticize one another for small betrayals of the old ways. True su misura tailoring, for example, can't really be taught in schools, Vincenzo told me, because the environment is like a factory. To illustrate his point, he grabbed a half-finished jacket and pointed to the collar and the lining, which he said would be pre-made for students at many tailoring schools and factories. Here the work is old style, Vincenzo told me. It's the same as 30 or 40 years ago. This is only possible, he and Roberto emphasized, through the kind of apprenticeship that is now virtually impossible. The kind that afforded them time enough for making mistakes, refining techniques, and developing general rapport with their father's customers. When I asked how long it was before each of them felt competent in tailoring, Vincenzo said it required 15 years of hard work, while Roberto told me he is still learning every day. That learning takes place in a cozy basement workshop beneath the salon where they measure, cut, and stitch beneath bright overhead lighting. Making suits is very different from selling them, and the world of the craftsperson is different from that of the salesperson, even when they are the same individual. Mere steps away from the salon, which is all wood, leather, fabric, and fine art, the laboratorio feels almost like a locker room. On the walls, photos of soccer stars clipped from newspapers hang alongside framed awards and old photographs of Renato Chiardi. The radio is turned to a sports station. Any hint of wealth is visible only to the trained eye. Even the most glamorous tailored clothing tends to look unimpressive as a work in progress, like something your cat took out of the closet and tore apart. Rolls of fabric worth thousands of euros could be mistaken for an old carpet someone put on the shelf and forgot about. From a rack at the back of the workshop, Vincenzo grabbed an unfinished winter coat he'd been working on for a client in Senegal and invited me to touch. The fabric was an exorbitantly expensive vicuna wool. And yet, however handsome, there was little to distinguish the coat, which cost as much as a nice automobile, from the linen jacket Vincenzo called me next. On the rack, they are merely luxurious clothes. It is the wearer that makes them something more. What separates bespoke tailoring from stealth wealth brands owned by the luxurious conglomerates who specialize in very, very high-end, ready-to-wear, is that the former is concerned only with scarce fabrics when the client is concerned with them. Rather than luxury, Neapolitan tailors talk about elegance, but the ultimate aim, Vincenzo told me, is freedom. To have a suit that feels like a second skin, embodies the cool nonchalance of sprecciatura, and represents the pinnacle of customization. Increasingly, those searching for it are overseas clients. About twice each year, Vincenzo travels to Japan and South Korea for fittings with customers in finance and industry. Prominent Middle Eastern customers occasionally travel to Naples to have suits made at Ciardi. And from America, clients include famous actors, executives, and business magnates, names you would know if not for the privacy they have come to expect from their tailors. On our way out of the workshop, after walking past a photo of Renato Ciardi with Antonio Panico, I was reminded of the succession crisis facing Italy's great tailoring families, one distant from the labor crisis, and in many ways a result of their own good fortune. Roberto Ciardi told me he had a daughter at university and a 14-year-old son who had not yet decided what he wanted to do. Given the choice, it seemed that his heirs apparent were more likely to attend university than to take up the apprenticeship in tailoring. Alessandra Rubinacci, meanwhile, told me her children had not yet decided what to do, but that young people today all seem interested in becoming TikTok influencers. On my last day in Naples, I met Antonio Panico, who received Italy's closest equivalent to knighthood, the Cavaliere del Lavoro. Panico was born in 1941 on the outskirts of Naples in what was known as Tailor's Town and started his training at age 11. It was the tradition here, he told me. Many thousands of boys took that leap once they were 8, 9, or 10. As it happened, he trained first with legendary figures, Giuseppe Ruotolo, then Niccolò Blasi, and finally in Naples with Roberto Combattanti. Even back then, it seems, there was a sense that tailoring traditions were changing with the younger generation. Like Combattanti, who had started learning at a very young age, Panico showed himself early on to be a prodigy of sorts. He was just 17 when his apprenticeships ended, opening a shop of his own only several years later. When he began working at Rubinacci in 1970, Panico said, he soon became head cutter, wasting no time stepping out of Vincenzo Ottolini's shadow. In a 2017 interview with an Italian fashion magazine, Mariano Rubinacci recalled his genius through the story of a jacket Panico made for him. At the time, the minimum weight for a jacket was 9 ounces, Rubinacci said. 7 ounces was impossible. And yet, when Rubinacci asked his head cutter to make a jacket from a very fine gabardine wool he'd been using for safari shirts, Panico proved that it was possible after all. He created an incredible blazer, Rubinacci said. It was like breaking the sound barrier. Today, the elder statesman of Neapolitan tailoring remains the most stylish man in a famously stylish city. Dressed in white pants with a striped dress shirt whose cuffs and collar seem to crash like waves against the beachhead of a dark blue blazer, Panico greeted me with his smoker's warm baritone. More than any other sartoria, Panico reminded me that tailoring is an art form. Tables and floors were adorned with sculptures, small and large, and the walls were crowded with dozens of beautiful paintings. Beyond the main salon is a small room where tall wooden cabinets are piled high with stacks of fabric, and beyond that is a fitting room bathed in natural light. On the wall of that room, Panico pointed to a photograph from a tailoring symposium in 2016, and he said with pride that it showed a gathering of the most famous tailors in the world. Among them were Edward Sexton, the Savile Row tailor who dressed Mick Jagger, the Beagles, and Yoko Ono, Lorenzo Sifonelli, a fourth generation tailor whose Paris atelier is one of the most famous French purveyors of Italian heritage, and of course, Panico himself. Panico suits are cut and stitched within the building where the sartoria is located, with his son Luigi doing the cutting in an atelier inside the shop. Although the old maestro retired a couple of years ago, he said that tailoring is like a virus that will not leave him. Clearly, it's the process rather than the final result that captivates him still. Panico still remembers the last suit he ever made, down to the buttons, but he is not sentimental. For him, it was just another suit. For any master tailor, the most important suit in the world seems to be the one that is not yet made. Even in retirement, Panico begins each day with a trip here, where he observes his son's progress as a fabric cutter and greets and meets customers. Like his father, Luigi started his training early on, at 14. But whatever Sartoria Panico becomes with Luigi as its creative director, it will probably be something different from what his father made it. And yet, in every cut and every flourish of his measuring tape, there will be some trace of his father and every master tailor he ever worked with. Luigi is 56, and with help from his sister Paola, he is working hard to give clients what they have come to expect from his father. How well he does when the man is no longer there to watch over him may depend on how the labor crisis in Italian tailoring gets resolved. Every Panico suit depends as much on skilled stitchers as on Luigi's discerning eye and steady shears. If tailoring ceases to be a working-class profession built on years of training and apprenticeship in the old ways, the assembly, line approach to bespoke tailoring might save the industry while killing the profession. 5 or 10 years from now, one of two things is likely to change. The definition of the term master tailor or the definition of the term bespoke suit. Before our interview, I sat quietly with Antonio Panico, whose eyes moved over me as I sipped my coffee. After a week spent scrutinizing the hands of every tailor I met, I suddenly realized it's the eyes that best show what is lost when one generation of master tailors supplants another. Tradition, after all, is a way of seeing the world before it becomes a way of acting on it. For a master tailor, each suit is a set of problems standing in the way of a new reality. To shape that new reality from whole cloth requires first seeing a person so clearly that they might find some hidden part of themselves. It requires seeing the future, and for the first time in Antonio Panico's long life, the future is unclear. The author of this, Joshua Hunt, is a writer in Portland, Oregon, and a former Tokyo-based correspondent for Reuters. Well, I hope you enjoy this as much as I enjoyed finding good news out there. This is Angela Glosser from Sun Sounds, Arizona. See you next time.